You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and today it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Michael Parenti. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Susan.
Well, it's great to have you, and let me tell our listeners a little about you. You're one of the country's most astute political analysts.
I won't argue.
You got your PhD in political science from Yale, and you have taught at a number of universities. At this point, though, you are devoting yourself full-time to writing and lecturing.
That's correct.
And what we're going to do today, I'm going to call you Michael, if that's okay.
That's fine.
We're going to have a conversation about, you're very prolific. You've done 12 to 14 books.
20 books.
20 books.
Mm-hmm.
Even more prolific than I thought. And we're going to touch on some of the topics that you are an expert in.
Okay.
And I'm going to first invite you to pick up on the terrorism trap, September 11th and beyond. You mentioned that we need to move away from liberal complaints about how bad things are and toward a radical analysis that explains why they are so.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about why they are so.
Well, let's take the example of Iraq. The discussion or public debate on Iraq, as it was for about 10 years with Vietnam, I recall, is limited to those who say we can win as opposed to those who say we cannot win. What's left out are those who say we shouldn't be there and there's no such thing as winning, that this war does not represent the interests of the American people nor the interests of the Iraqi people. It's been a disaster for them. But also, the critics today confine themselves to thinking the war was stupid, it's ill-defined, it's the work of an arrogant, incompetent named George Bush. And I would argue that Iraq as a war and as a venture has been very good for any number of people. It's been wonderful for about 100 fairly large corporations, including a few giants like Kellogg and Halliburton and Bechtel and such, who made very nice fat cow. Blackwater make very nice, enormous profits for doing very little. There's no supervision, not even carrying out what they're supposed to do. The goal and the intent and the purpose in Iraq from the very beginning, even when they went in and they thought they had won it and mission was accomplished, remember those first days?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that happened was that mass looting took place. The entire Iraqi government was stripped and destroyed. The museums were stripped and destroyed. Their civilization, their collective memory, every ministry except the oil ministry was destroyed. And the goal really is to plunder Iraq, to use Iraq as an excuse to plunder the U.S. Treasury, because the more money you can spend into debt, the more you are privatizing your federal budget. The greater your debt, the larger is that portion of your tax dollar just goes to private creditors. who float this debt. So you've got that happening. You've got an excuse to build up a monumental debt which redistributes income from hardworking taxpayers to rich creditors and privatizes the federal budget.
Privatizes the federal budget in terms of this money is owed to
private creditors. That's right. It also was a good excuse to inflate still further the military budget. So this budget, which is a very profitable budget, it's even more profitable than pharmaceuticals and guaranteed cost overruns and non-competitive contracts and all this. Increasing, skyrocketing the military spending as big as it was to another 30-40% growth. I mean, all of that. So Iraq has achieved all those things. It also achieved the destruction of a troublesome regime that was not fitting itself in the free market global system. It had a leadership that was self-defining Iraq and self-developing it. It was also a leadership that was very brutal and killed an awful lot of people when Saddam Hussein was working for the CIA. I mean, he got his break with the CIA. That's a fact that has gone down the memory hole, giving you why Iraq serves a lot of wonderful purposes. And the kill ratio is low. I mean, Richard Nixon beat George McGovern to get reelected as U.S. president in 72. He was losing 110 U.S. soldiers a week. Bush is losing 80 a month, it averages out too. Some months it's 60, some months it's 100, but it's about 80 a month. That's being sustained. But he's talking about wars, and we've got wars, and we've got this terror. But on the other hand, he's telling people to go shopping, and there's no rationing, there's no hardship here. Nobody's got an inconvenience by it. So what you're doing is you're establishing U.S. power in this country. You're taking a country that where the entire economy was state-controlled and state-owned, and you have destroyed it and privatized it. And privatization means, in many cases, as it did in Eastern Europe and Russia, it really means shutting it down. So you cut out any competitive kind of stuff. And you close out a public economy, and you destroy it. I think mission accomplished is correct. That's what's happened. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean there aren't problems and political costs now, and how do we get out of it, and so forth and so on. He doesn't want to get out. He's sitting on, at today's oil prices, he's sitting on maybe $15 trillion worth of oil, high-quality crude oil. That's why he says, hey, we've been 60 years in Korea, we may have to be 30 years in Iraq, if we could be in Korea, in Germany, 60 years.
Well, why doesn't he just say we're there because we can make a huge profit at it? Why does he keep saying it's about democracy and freedom, and why do people want to feel that it is about democracy and freedom and not just about, you know, making money? Because America is a capitalist country. What's wrong with making money?
Well, it's a hard sell to say, I've got to spend your tax money and the blood of your sons and daughters so that Exxon, which could buy this oil from Iraq, they're willing to sell it to the American market and to American distributors. Instead of having to buy it from Iraq and make their 20% profit, they can now own the oil outright and make their, whatever, 80%, whatever the profits are. You can't say that.
I agree. You know, you shouldn't say that. But at the same time, people are very comfortable here, and they don't want to give that up. If they know that, you know, they may have to lose a little bit of face in the rest of the world in order to maintain their privilege, you know, is there anything?
Well, that's one of the disinformational factoids, I'm sorry, that are sent around, which is that we'd lose access to that oil. Everyone in these countries wants to sell oil to us. They all do. Mm-hmm. It's that instead of selling it, these companies want to own it outright. And it's just immensely more profitable. Look, the appeal has been always, the way you get the U.S. public to support the empire, because the empire feeds off the republic, the empire consumes the resources of the republic. It consumes the talent of young men and women. It consumes all sorts of resources and fuel. The military is the biggest single fuel consumer in America, by the way. and biggest single polluter. The way you get them to invade Panama, invade Grenada, invade bomb Iraq, destroy Yugoslavia, a viable social democratic democracy that was moving toward democracy, and break it up into a bunch of little right-wing mini-republics where everything is privatized, everything is deregulated, unemployment is high, people are poor, and American capital prevails. The way you do that is you don't tell people, we are trying to establish a brutal free market global system that will benefit the top fraction of 1% of this country. And that's what you got to get behind. They won't be behind. But you give them two themes. You give them two reasons. One, you play on their pride. And you say, America is a messianic nation. It has a message for the world. It's a glowing example to the world. And we'll bring democracy, or not just democracy, we'll bring stability and safety and comfort for these people. We'll get rid of these evildoers, and we're fighting for good. And the even more effective appeal is fear. When you say there are terrorists out to get you, terrorists are going to come here, terrorists are going to do that. 9/11 was a blessing. It was a godsend to them. Those are the two things that rally the people around the security of their country, which means they rally around the flag, and the flag itself is wrapped around the president. There's a kind of idiocy that takes over the populace. They're reduced to a kind of idiocy, and yet it's remarkable how they see through some of that idiocy. The manipulators use the same scenario time and again, whether it's Noriega in Panama, or Gaddafi in Libya, or Chavez in Venezuela, or Milosevic in Yugoslavia, or Saddam Hussein, who was a real brutal dictator, but at his most brutal time, they loved him. He was their poster boy. But now he's an independent. He's committing economic nationalism. So every one of these guys, they demonize the leader. They say he's terrible. He's committing terrible atrocities. We've got to ride in like the cavalry in the old Indian movies and save these people. And every time the public rallies around the president, and our own security is at stake, because this guy's like another Hitler, that one's another Hitler, that every single one of them has been called another Hitler. Every one of the names I just gave you. So, I mean, it's like this exact same script. And you just white out the name and put another name in, and there are millions of people in this country who buy that exact same script every time. But what also is remarkable, along with this remarkable American idiocy, is the remarkable American suspicion and distrust that begins to set in, that despite this, despite the way the media collaborates with the White House and then limits itself to these little marginal critiques about operation at the operational level, oh, it's not working that well and all that, despite all that, the people begin to sense that this thing isn't in my interest. I'm paying this money. We got no money for our schools. We're closing down our public hospitals. We're cutting back the hours on the library. We can't get these bridges fixed and they're collapsing. We don't have the money. We don't have enough money for forest services. They're cutting back on forest services. Who knows how many of those fires could have been avoided if we had a full staff forest service. Every town or city or state, when I travel around the country, the same thing. City budget in crisis, state assembly cutting back on this and that. Because all this money is now going to pay for this empire, this insatiable empire. And people are beginning to say, what's in it for us? What is this all about, really? It's been 4 years, and I don't see any end in sight. And more people are getting killed, and it's costing more and more. What's in this for us? So they do, despite this monopoly of propaganda that bombards them all the time and the insipid, pale, little critical opposition that follows up, comes trickling up a few years too late, usually, too little too late. You know, they can't develop a totally critical analysis because they don't get this kind of analysis that we're making right now. But they do see that there's something wrong and their support does retract.
Takes a long time, though, and as you say, it's like now we're hearing the same rhetoric around Iran.
Yes. Oh, there's another country. Ahmadinejad is another Hitler or Well, they used to say he's a maniac, and they that's another favorite of theirs is to say the leader is imbalanced, mentally imbalanced. Mm-hmm. Gaddafi,
Chavez
is mentally imbalanced. Aristide in Haiti was mentally imbalanced. Ahmadinejad. I read Ahmadinejad's statements, and they sound very civilized and humane. He says, "Can we not live in peace all together? There are differences we have. There should be room for development and not for expropriating the destiny and resources of another country. And then we could assist each other mutually in mutual development." I mean, he says things that I wish U.S. leaders would say. And then I hear that he's a nutcase and he's a this and he's a that and so forth.
He's a homophobe. That's the latest one.
He's a homophobe. Of course he's a homophobe. He's an Iranian Islamic fundamentalist. And like the Roman Catholics in this country who announced, I just heard a Monsignor on the radio the other day, that homosexuality is a sin and a disorder. This was Father Sigmund Freud, I guess his name was. I forget it. I didn't get it. But he's got this all analyzed, you see. Ahmadinejad hasn't made... He never said we have no homosexuals in Iran. He said it's not a problem.
Exactly.
Because it's rather suppressed. That's why it's not a problem.
Yeah, okay.
Nobody in Iran is pushing for same-sex marriage. Yeah.
The other thing that he is promoted as being is a total anti-Semite who wants to throw all the Jews into the sea.
That's false, too. There's a Jewish community in Iran that lives there in peace, and about I think 70,000 or 80,000 of Jews live in Iran. I mean, they've integrated into the society.
Yeah, but how do we not get that sort of information out? Why is it always so one-sided? It's as though, as you called it a little while back, the memory hole just kind of takes us over, and we are not able to track details.
Because the information is orchestrated by major mainstream media that share the interests of corporate America and its global empire. They're not close to corporate America. They are corporate America. One of them is an active, militant tool for the Republican Party, and that's Fox Network. I mean, for the right wing, the ultra-right wing in this country. Rupert Murdoch made that point years ago. I quoted him in a book years ago. He said, "I'm not a conservative. I'm a radical conservative." And that means an ultra-conservative. Yeah, he wants it. He was rolling it all back.
Let me remind our listeners that this is Raising San Radio, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Parente on all sorts of interesting things about American culture, who we are as a people, and how we get sucked into propaganda so easily. But you also mentioned a few moments ago that there is always this little resistance. Let's talk a little bit about the left as a resistance in this country and some of what happens with the left as a resistance. I have and do work with different political groups, and I always think of them as progressive, and yet when we start working together, we have an enormous amount of trouble with our own personalities. Some people want to be the celebrity superstar on, you know, the media. Other people want to be the superstar around press or whatever. And so my experience is, and I don't know that this is every person on the left, but my experience is that we have an enormous amount of trouble just coming up with a way to be a resistance, be a voice, to try and get people to understand some of what you're talking about here.
We live in a very individualized, egocentric society. It's not like we're all village people and everybody pretty much accepts everybody else, and you know, you shouldn't stand out too much or start doing a trip on other people all the time. And all that. In fact, this culture, especially with TV, it's all tripping. It's all everybody go out and pursue your stardom of one kind or another. I guess there would be those kinds of differences. There also are sectarians on the left. There are some people who are against corporate capitalism and imperialism. They're against it, but that's not their real passion. Their real passion is to fight imaginary hordes of Stalinists or Marxists, you know. There are others on the left like that too, who are open to those toward the right of them, more in the mainstream, always looking to be able to link up with them, and who are horrified at anybody further left of them. So you have these kind of sectarian and anti-sectarian, whatever you want to call them, views. The intellectuals on the left in America are as bad as the ones in Europe. Almost all of them are still waging war over Barcelona or Kronstadt or the Third International versus the Fourth International, or whatever else. So those you don't want to organize with people like that. They don't really do much anyway. They usually just get into fights with each other. And then there are also agents that penetrate the movements and are very adept at stymieing it, killing the feeling of a meeting by getting up and monopolizing the microphone. And their assignment is to undermine the meeting and be as divisive as possible. And we know, for instance, that New Politics convention that was held many, many years ago, this is back in the 60s, and there was a group of African-Americans who came in and began attacking the other African-Americans who were in the group, saying you're selling out and you're collaborating with whitey and being ultra-left, ultra-militant black. It turns out now that was Operation Chaos, and it was a CIA operation, threatening, and they disrupted and they destroyed that conference.
And when did this information come out that this was a planned operation?
Oh, like 20, 30 years later.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I was at a conference, and the Prairie Fire people, it was in Chicago, they were sort of descendants from the Weathermen. I think they were sort of offshoot or something. They got in that conference and they just messed it up, with one person pursuing this. And why aren't we talking about the crisis that gays are facing with AIDS? Identity politics was used for about 35 years as a way of avoiding any kind of awareness about political economy. Instead, there would always be somebody getting up and saying, why aren't there more blacks here? Or why aren't there more women? Or why aren't there more gay? Or why aren't we talking about AIDS or sexism or racism? I don't ignore those other subjects. What I try to show is how they fit in a overall system of exploitation and of division and elitism.
And one of the things that I believe is happening here is that the education system is going downhill really fast. It seems like people don't really feel comfortable thinking, period, and thinking their own thoughts is a little bit even more scary.
Well, you don't really have to think anymore. I mean, you can just, sit in front of the little screen or the big screen or whatever. And certainly literacy seems to be going down, but don't start me on that subject.
Okay, let's avoid that one.
That's just a writer's grievances at copy editors.
Let's start talking about the amount of money that the military sucks up and the military industry, and whether there's a way that we can back away from that at this point, because so much of our tax dollars go to that industry.
Yes. The billion, hundreds of billions, it's now $500 billion military budget. It's really more than that if you count the nuclear weaponry stuff that's done through the Department of Energy and the big chunk that has to go to pay the national debt, which is part of, due to military spending, proportionate. So it's an enormous, it's probably more like $700 billion. Well, you can take pieces of that and create all sorts of jobs that have a much better multiplier effect than military spending does, and rebuild the infrastructure of this country. Start building high-powered monorail systems. We have right here in California, there's a plan that you can take a downtown San Francisco monorail and you can be in Los Angeles in 2 hours. But they won't build it. They won't build it because it costs $40 billion. Well, $40 billion, we spend that in a week in Iraq,
right.
A couple of weeks. So these are the things. There's an immense backload. I mean, this country's standards, the public capital is almost getting to be like third world level. It really is. I mean, the expansion of decent amenities in this society stopped after the New Deal. If you go and you find the park services and all sorts of things, almost all of this were New Deal creations. And I said to myself, my God, what would we have done if we hadn't had a depression and hadn't had the New Deal? But since then, it's been rollback. It's been opening up those public parks to private exploitation and such. So everything is going in the wrong direction. Developing solar energy, developing wind energy, and things that need to be desperately done. Instead, you have Bush pursuing ethanol, which takes more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol. You know, it takes about, I don't know, 5 units of energy to produce 1 unit of energy of ethanol. But that's what they want. They want things that are expensive. The things that are expensive make profits for them. We can learn to economize. We can be doing much more. We can bring the medical industry under control. Every discussion on health care says, with rising health costs, and I keep saying, why are there rising health costs? Why?
Mm-hmm.
It can't be labor costs, because most caregivers in hospitals, they work at very low wages. It can't be the doctors anymore, because the doctors have been taken over by the HMOs. It's the HMOs and the insurance companies and the drug companies, and they are ripping and ripping and grabbing, and the greed is just boundless. Well, these things have to be reined in. They do. We need to launch a counter-propaganda and get the American people to understand that government isn't their sole enemy or major enemy. That is, when government becomes the tool of the plutocracy and the plundering robber barons that we have today, that's when it's a problem. I think also there's a general feeling of not wanting people to be so autonomous and being able to have all these choices and being able to have an expectation level where they can make their own lives and they can go to college and they can do all these things. They are trying to get the population back down to a third world kind of population, poor, because the poorer and hungrier they can make you, the harder you will work for less. That's why you're willing to work for less. That's why Haitians line up for jobs that pay 20 cents an hour or 15 cents an hour, or people in Indonesia. We would never line up for jobs that paid like that. But that's not because we're so much more self-respecting. It's because we're at a level of historical struggle where we've moved beyond that, and we've organized, and we're able to extract a better living. But there was a time when, in the 1920s, the U.S. was a third world country. It did have a middle class of a sort, but most people were very poor. Tuberculosis was a common disease, diphtheria. A lot of the diseases of the poor, malnutrition. When World War II started, about 5 million young males in this country were rejected from the army. They were in such bad shape. Mm-hmm. 5 million out of maybe the first 15 million call-up, or 20 million call-up. Mm-hmm. It's about a third of the nation right there. Today, in America, 30% of the people over the age of 65 have no teeth. That's because we have Medicare, but Medicare does not cover dental insurance, and people can't afford. Dental insurance is kind of expensive. And so what happens if you're 30 or 40, and it's happening every day, you can't afford to get an implant or a bridge or a root canal, whatever else. I don't know how good those things are anyway, but so you get a teeth yanked out and your diet isn't that great and all that. And by the time you reach old age and there's no dental insurance, it costs incredible amounts of money.
How long will people put up with this? And what will they do when they finally say, okay, that's it, I've had enough of this?
Well, it's a remarkable system. I mean, I think the United States is the most successfully repressed country in the world, in the sense that the people think they have a free and independent press, and it's not. The people think the government does respond, and it doesn't. The people all distrust politicians, and you say, what do you think of these people? Oh, they're a bunch of crooks. Oh, they're a but they have their friends and they are all special influence peddlers and all that. But when those very same politicians start talking about an alien enemy, then they just lovingly rally around, follow him off the edge of the cliff into one abyss or another. So it's a very clever system. They're distracted by more and more puffery. They know more about Britney Spears than they do about their city council budget or anything like that. But you know, the truth is, if they gave it some time, the city council budget is more interesting than Britney Spears. Crashing boar. What the hell? What the hell we got to hear about her? Is she wearing this hat? Is she wearing that hat?
She's pregnant again?
Or she went into rehab? Yeah. Well, what the hell is that all about?
Don't know. You tell me. You're American. The other thing the question that they ask, and I hear even people that are progressive ask this question, you know, why do they hate us?
Well, some of the more politically literate people in other parts of the world make it clear that they don't hate the American people. They hate what the government is doing to the global economy and to their particular country and to their livelihoods and all that. Why wouldn't the Iraqis hate us? They had a country that had the highest standard of living in the Middle East just 5 years ago, and today it's totally devastated.
Mm-hmm.
4 or 5 million refugees have gone off into other countries living total destitution. Power systems that work 2 hours a day. 40% unemployment in Iraq. People dying here, caught in these horrible wars, some of them from competing Islamic sects, others from U.S. sources. I mean, U.S. has been backing terror groups in Iraq to terrorize the population. They call it the Salvadoran solution.
Mm-hmm. Salvadoran option.
The Salvadoran option, right, thank you. So they're rather upfront about that. Of course they'll hate us, why wouldn't they?
Well, yeah. But, I mean, you can use that term, the Salvadoran option. It doesn't necessarily mean that it resonates here, because Salvador was a 20 years ago, well, 30 years ago now, in the 80s.
Right, unless you explain what it is, well, you have to explain it, and you don't get a chance to explain that on NBC, CBS, ABC, or Fox.
And even if you do, then they think that you're, you know, blowing things up, and you know, we don't torture, you know, we don't do these things.
Right.
So it's like knocking on wood sometimes to try and get these ideas across.
Yes. Now the torture story did break through the invisible ceiling there, the invisible cap on it.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these things break through. And the only reason it broke through was because there was a sensationalist aspect to it at Abu Ghraib, where it wasn't, the tortures actually were, as torture goes, they were not the worst tortures, but they involved nudity, and they involved female guards humiliating male prisoners and all, and this was so, and you got all these guys in Congress saying, this is the most shocking, horrible thing ever. Oh, that was not. You can go to what happened in Argentina or Chile, or through Central America, where they tortured parents in front of children and children in front of parents, and they put rats up women's vaginas and did all. I mean, I've got accounts of that in my book Against Empire, and earlier works too. The torture, what's called torture now, and the torture in Vietnam was horrible. But so that little sensationalist thing is what got torture on the issue agenda. Finally, you know,
torture is there is a definition of it, and there is a definition of what's legal and what's illegal. Not mm-hmm. that torture is ever legal, and it's right there written down in the Geneva Conventions, but we've decided that they don't apply anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes me a little uncomfortable to say there are worse tortures. It's when you're going against the Geneva Convention describing what it is, and we've decided that that's doesn't really matter. I think we should tease it out a little.
Yeah, well, you know, by the way, that may answer your earlier question. I mean, there's a lot of people in the world who are aware that the U.S. has U.S. leaders have elevated their government's doings above all international law and Geneva Convention or any of the other, the ICC, the International Crime Court, which the U.S. says we will participate, just as long as all U.S. military and governmental personnel are immune from any kind of prosecution. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's just this incredible arrogance of we operate above the law because we are the world's lawmakers. We will decide.
Mm-hmm.
Just setting up hit lists of who's going to live and who's going to die. And that explains why, you know, when the U.S. was getting ready to invade, when George Bush was getting ready to invade Iraq in February 2003, you had demonstrations in 70 or 80 countries around the world, mm-hmm. including countries like Finland and Japan, you know, Nigeria. I mean, these are not countries that have any cultural or historical link to Iraq, any close thing. But what they were saying was, yes, we're concerned about the Iraqi people, but they also were saying the U.S. does not have the right to get up and just invade any country they want and publish lists. Cheney said, oh, there's 30 or 40 more countries that we want to look at, or axis of evil, and you decide this is the hit list, and we will decide who shall live and who shall die. And that's what they've done in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And now they're sort of setting Iran up the same way. They can't invade Iran, of course, because Iran is twice as big as Iraq, and it's a hilly country, and it's a huge population. They would need more than half a million troops. They don't have them, and no other country's going to go in with them on that. But they could bomb Iran. They have all the targets. They could totally destroy the country from the air, mm-hmm. the way they did with Yugoslavia and Serbia.
We remind our listeners that we're talking with Dr. Michael Parente, and this is Raising Sand. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and I want to just mention that there are birds out here because they're sitting outside. And on Raising Sand, Dr. Parente, we like to go where it's pleasurable to be, and
okay.
today it's fun and nice to be out here.
Yeah. And the present government is for the birds anyway, it really is. So. Okay,
maybe that's what the birds are telling us.
Right.
Now, I want to invite you to talk about Afghanistan. I first of all want to say that it's a puzzle to me where military families, of which I am one, will say the war in Afghanistan is a righteous war, but the war in Iraq is illegal. They're meaning that it's okay to bomb Afghanistan because, after all, Osama bin Laden was protected by or living in Afghanistan. But let's open that one up and talk about Afghanistan.
Afghanistan had a democratic revolution. You see, the point that's overlooked is every country in the Middle East, Egypt, Syria, Iraq. Iraq had an incredible democratic revolution in 1958. Afghanistan was on its way to... It had a left military that took over and was doing land reform and extending education to women and opening up women's rights and before the Soviet intervention. And then they were targeted by the CIA and the Pakistani ISI. They were in that country disrupting and destabilizing before the Soviets came in. The Afghan left military government was under siege, and it repeatedly requested from Moscow, come on in. The Soviets did not want to go in. They saw it as a quagmire for many a nation. The British never were able to subdue Afghanistan. Nobody had. But they went in. And that, of course, opened it up. Godless communists were in, and now the U.S. went and armed every one of these mujahideen whom they're now fighting in other places.
And I think we need to just repeat that. These folks were armed by the United States government.
Yes. Osama bin Laden worked with the CIA. And that's not my analysis. I mean, I even heard that on the major media back in 2003, where some correspondent very casually announced, well, the CIA has been close with both sides here and all the people, you know, operatives and blah, blah, blah. And a lot of those mujahideen went back to Algeria, for instance, and started... whacking the government that was there. So the choice you're left with in some of these countries, Egypt may be another one, I think Algeria may be one, certainly Afghanistan, is between, or Turkey is another good example, between a repressive, secular, militaristic, right-wing government versus a even more thoroughly repressive, militant, extremist Islamic, a certain variety of Islam government that would be even more repressive, certainly of women, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so those become the two choices. That's what you're looking at. And in Afghanistan, that's what you got. Now, the choice is between the UN, a kind of UN thinly cloaked imperialism going in there, bombing and hitting them and all that, or a Taliban that would strangle and suffocate them. That's really is a failed policy in that sense. But the U.S. is really not interested in Afghanistan. There's no great population. There's no great strategic value.
Isn't there oil nearby in the Central Asia?
Yeah, but are there large oil reserves in Afghanistan? Sure. I don't think so.
Afghanistan? No, but I think it's a pipeline route, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that might be. But there could be other routes for that oil. I think the invasion of Afghanistan was an excuse or an opening to invade Iraq. They said, oh, you know, we've gone in there, we're going after the bad guys and all that. But they didn't. The U.S. has what? I think the U.S. has about not more than 20 or 25,000 troops in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It's hardly a major operation, really.
Well, I think in the summer it escalates, and in the winter it kind of dies down, right?
Because
of the weather.
Is your son in Afghanistan or Iraq?
He has been in Afghanistan. He's
really?
In Iraq now, yeah. He was in Afghanistan in 2003.
Mm-hmm. The war in Afghanistan has been going on for now almost 7 years, right? It's going into its seventh year pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. So, Michael Parente, talk a little bit about the fear that is developing in this country, this culture, around Arab culture, that they hate the Jews, that there's a very intense desire to destroy Israel.
Most Palestinians have, over the last 30 or 40 years, have accepted the existence of Israel, but they want their own state, and they want better treatment. They want the settlers out of their lands. And they want to be able to develop a Palestinian state. And I don't think the Israelis have been letting them do that. And they have encouraged the settlers. The little window dressing withdrawal from Gaza Strip and then using Gaza as a shooting gallery after you get the Jews out and start shooting everybody that's moving in there. I'm not so sure you can fault the Arabs for disliking what the Israelis have done in that area. Do we mean Arab culture, or do we mean Islamic culture? Because that could include Persians, it could include Indonesians and others. And there is this kind of other, what is it, Sharia, religious rule. And that's very troubling, I would say. And the treatment of women in countries like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and other places, it's just horrible. And in Afghanistan under the Taliban, the treatment of women in a lot of countries, not just Islamic though, but in Africa and Latin America and other parts of Asia, especially at the village level, is just absolutely horrible. You know, I wrote a book called The Culture Struggle, which deals with racism and gender oppression, and fitting them into the context of whole cultures and showing how cultures are not neutral practices and entities the way some anthropologists might suggest, but cultures become both instruments of power and products of power. So these are very real and very troubling problems. And the mirror image of these Sharia people, and by that, they're people who say that God's word should be lived and the whole society should be organized around what God wants. And this is what God wants, is what Allah has said what the prophet has given us, and this whole society is damned because of its modernity. And modernity is a code word for women are equal to men, and they go out and around, and they're secular, and they
can drive,
and they can drive cars, and they can do this and that and the other thing, and people get divorced, and people have sexual relations. And
although I think that Sharia also is getting a little bit of a bad rap, because I think that there is extreme Sharia, but I think that Sharia was set up as a legal system to actually give women some rights, including the right to divorce if they wanted to. I think in different parts of the world, Sharia is much more extreme, but I think at some level it was...
Right, I'm talking about the extremists. You don't hear about all these other... And it's the same with Christianity. The goal in this country, the stated goal by people like Randall Terry, for instance, who says, we don't want equal time. Let a wave of intolerance wash over you. Our God is an intolerant God. They say this again. I hear a Christian minister say this. This God is an intolerant God. We want complete rule. We don't want pluralism. We want rule. And if this God is true, and if these teachings are true, then what we're living now is a falsehood, and we therefore have to impose this law on everybody because we are right. We are carrying out God's word, and you who oppose that are living in sin and are an agent of Satan. It's Manichaean, and it's very extreme, and yes, there are many Christians who do not believe that.
What is your view of the future?
Oh, looking glass, the future, hey?
You've been in this field for some time.
Yeah,
with
a crystal ball. I did make one major prediction when the Soviet Union was overthrown. I said, this will not represent the great gain for the left. Well, everybody was saying, this is wonderful and all that. What we've had is a free market go in, and instead of peace, we've had more wars, the U.S. invading and attacking more countries than they ever did before. But predictions are tricky, and crystal ball questions are, there are too many of them on the media where they're constantly being asked to predict the immediate future instead of trying to understand the present that we're living in. And I think we're going to face crises ahead that are going to make today's problems look like child play. And I think in the economy and finance and in the environment that this is going to lead to all sorts of kinds of spin-off effects. And there are people even in government who are aware of this, and they're planning for it, and of course in the wrong way. They're planning for it in terms of adversarial killings when there's competition for resources, and how will we stave off the hordes that might want to come into our country. And so just the way you shouldn't be thinking about this. You should be thinking more and more urgently of everyone having to pull together because we're all on the same planet. I think it's a pretty tough struggle ahead.
Well, thank you for your time and for sharing your lovely backyard.
Thank you.
Well, that was an in-depth conversation with Dr. Michael Parente. You can learn more about Michael Parente and his work at his website, www.michaelparente.org, michaelparente.org. You'll see his list of books, including Contrary Notions, The Michael Parente Reader, Democracy for a Few, The Culture Struggle, Super Patriotism, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. Very long list of books. Go take a look at his website, as I say, michaelparente.org. Also, speaking engagements are listed there and ways to get in touch with Michael Parente. We conducted that interview in his backyard along with the birds and other critters and creatures that live back there, and a very nice afternoon. I want to remind you that all of our shows are available at our website, which is www.raisingsandradio.org. and you can go and listen to any of our shows. We have a little search box, and you can find the kinds of shows that you want. You're welcome to use them. Just keep the integrity of the content and let us know when and where you use the shows. So again, www.raisingsandradio.org, or send me an email. I'll be really glad to hear from you and to find out what else you're interested in hearing. Next week we will be doing a show on the war. It's our third in our series of the Review of War. In the past, we've done interviews with soldiers, troops, as well as military families, so go and take a listen to that. And next week, we will be doing the same again. Military father, Dr. Andrew Busevich, will be speaking with us, and hope that you tune in. Music today was Four Non Blondes, What's Going On?
All views expressed on Raising Sand are that of the hosts and guests, not of KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Raising Sand on KZSU Stanford.